Okay. So, Jared, first, I want to first tell everyone how we met.
That deserves, that it's story deserves admission.
So feed. Cool. It's great. So cool. I want people to really get that.
So,
in your words.
In this day and age when it's so easy to be cynical about the absence of magic in the real world, we met magically. And it all revolved around a commitment we made to ourselves to do something for ourselves, to sort of boldly jump in a direction that seemed to be being opposed by the entire rest of the world. We met in the movie Cats, a screening in the movie Cats at Palm Beach Gardens. I believe it was Christmas Eve, if not the day before Christmas Eve. And we were both resigned to doing something that we enjoyed. World and opinions be damned. And from my perspective, I got there pretty much committed to enjoying whatever I was going to see because I read about the bad reviews and how much people wanted to take a crap on it. And I knew the people involved were so talented and such profound artists. I said, there's no way there's not something magical in here. And so I walked up to the theater and I saw somebody sitting underneath the poster outside, just sort of surveying the area. It was her and it was me. I was sort of meandering around the posters, you know, trying to figure out, is this someone else who's here to avoid suffering, to escape into something awesome? And so, I can't remember. I think I walked to look at some other posters before it was time to go, and then I walked in, and Cristiano was sitting in the, like, two rows back. I was sitting in the third row, leftmost seat, so I can rock it out at the credits usually. And that's how we met, over Cats. And she came and she boldly sat next to me, and we spoke. And I realized we both were there to let this piece of magic just sort of envelop us. And we realized we had a lot in common with why we were at the movie. We didn't get into specifics so much. Well, a few, maybe. Our parents passing and the subsequent difficulties of family stuff and the memories that penetrate during the holidays. And then I think at that point we both knew that whatever was going to be on screen, we would never forget it, no matter what. And the movie ended and we had a great talk, and it's one of the best stories I've ever had. It's even better than the story of how I rented from Pauly Shore in L.A., because that didn't really teach me a lesson. This taught me several lessons at once, which I'm still uncovering, and very happy that this organic friendship evolved without the need of any other instrument.
Yeah, me too. So, I saw Pauly Shore years and years ago at
Comedy Store?
Comedy Store.
Yeah. I lived right above it. I rented from him when I was out there in LA after my dad died, and that was just a kind of a typical celebrity experience, someone trying to cling to fame. And he was nice enough, but I mean, it's forgettable. I mean, I didn't grow as a person because of him.
Yeah. So what do you do? You're a teacher, you're a writer.
I went to school to be a doctor. I double majored in pre-med and creative writing at the University of Florida. I was going to be a physician like my dad. I wanted to also get my MD, PhD, dual degree so that I could develop non-invasive ligament repairs. Considering I'd torn both my knees playing football. Actually, the day my mom moved out of my dad's house, I tore my knee in a football game. That's how I remember that. So I had to sit at home with my knee torn, completely immobilized in a brand new house. But then I got all the way to biochem in college. going from like chemistry lab to like creative writing seminars, and everyone since I was young was like, oh, you're a writer, you should write, it's what you're good at. So I double majored because I wanted to combine what I was good at with what I thought I loved. And the further along I went in medicine, the more I realized I was doing it because I didn't feel like I had a choice. That, you know, I had to follow my dad's footsteps. He was a doctor in Miami for like 23 years. He ran the intensive care unit at Baptist Hospital in Miami. And then first ever girlfriend I ever had. First girlfriend I ever had at 20 years old. First ever girlfriend. Got pregnant. I was a junior in college, and I knew it was never going to work as a relationship. And so by the time my senior year rolled around and she was close to coming to term, I had already been barred from seeing her since I wasn't going to marry her. And my father the whole time said, you know, Jared, just treat yourself like you're a sperm donor. You know, you'll meet somebody, you'll have other children. You know, they clearly don't want you involved. And it wasn't because I was too young, it was because I knew it wouldn't have been a healthy relationship. I saw what my parents went through. At that point in time, without the support from my family, I vowed that I would be in my daughter's life when I could. And it just wasn't at that time. I divested myself from my medical aspirations and focused solely on my writing because I realized that's where my passion was. It took many years, but then I had a teacher tell me, my undergraduate advisor told me that my writing was very cinematic. And I, at that point, pursued screenwriting after graduating from UF. Took a year, I managed a gym and did all sorts of odd jobs until I got into a great grad program at Chapman University in Southern California. At that point, I'd seen my daughter once in 2 years.
What's her name?
Madison. And after that, I decided, I'm going to work for my daughter. I'm just distributing it differently. I'll come back home when I can. And since they weren't letting me see her, and there were no film schools worth going to within an hour drive of my daughter, and my father not supporting me, and at that point also being diagnosed with terminal cancer, telling me that he couldn't have a relationship with me if I fought for her in court because it would essentially ruin his life. He didn't want to see me hurt. But I resigned to go to grad school, and I got into the best one. I went to the best one that I could get into. Went out there, made my connections, got my degree. My dad got to see me graduate before he passed away. Still wasn't but seeing my daughter twice a year. She had no idea who I was. After he passed, I went out to LA to take a few more meetings, do a little bit more with a book I was helping my professor write. He created the original Transformers cartoons. His biography just came out like a year ago. Took many years because he's very old. He's almost 90. And I came back, and with my connections made, moved first to West Palm when I couldn't get any work near my daughter in Central Florida, then ultimately to Claremont, got work in Claremont, teaching middle school intensive reading up there, after teaching it for half a year at Forest Hill down here. And that's when I began the proceedings to fight for her, since at that point her mother had met a guy. My daughter still had no idea who I was told that she doesn't have a dad. And now fast forward 6 years, and
how's your relationship now?
One of the best relationships. It's my purpose. I am not a writer. I am not a dad per se. But
in this part, yes.
If you reverse that, if you take away my fatherhood, then I don't exist. My daughter resets my orbit every day.
Resets your orbit.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
How does she reset it?
Every day, every waking moment that I'm not predisposed with something that requires my attention, I'm wondering how I can make her life better. I'm thanking her.
She's probably wondering the same.
No. She's... You know, writing's not the easiest career. I'm fortunate to have a career in it, but it's thankless. It's joyless. It's driven many people to suicide. It's driven many people to insanity and all sorts of negativity. But when you have something that you love more than yourself, and when you yourself think that you love writing, and you love something more than yourself, therefore your writing will never truly own you. And that's what I have with my daughter, and I'm so grateful. And that's, she's just reminded me how important all my relationships are.
How so?
Because you can take away everything, but if you don't have people whom you can transmit yourself, really using other people as vessels for what you can offer. I mean, it's not even just having other people; it's loving other people.
Right. Yeah.
Without that, I would have nothing. I've had a lot taken away from me in the last couple of years, you know, just with the efforts with my writing. You know, they've required a lot of financial adjustments. They've caused me to strip away a lot of what I thought was important, particularly when.
What is important to you?
Those that I love. I mean, my daughter doesn't care what scripts I've sold. I mean, she might like to brag about it, just like I like to brag about my dad at one point. But, you know, my dad had his flaws, and that's ultimately what shaped me emotionally, not what he did for a living.
Right.
You know, so I'm very lucky that, you know, I have a manager. I've written scripts for Lionsgate. I've done a lot, but it's not the glamour lotto ticket that a lot of this looks like. And so
what kind of things do you like to write about?
Well, you were mentioning earlier about the interplay between dreams and reality and how they coordinate. That's the entire constitution, the manifesto of my writing. So the script that got me representation, which Shia LaBeouf's manager recently called Too Insane, was written shortly after I was the first screenplay I ever wrote when I decided I was going to write for my daughter. It's called Clay Tommy. After I decided to write, my father, instead of, I thought, being disappointed, I should have known, he's an artist, he wanted to be a filmmaker, but his mother forced him to go to medical school. I was doing what he loved, and one of the ways that he showed that for me was by sending me this great big package of gifts when I got back to the University of Florida, showering me in support. And that included many books on screenwriting, and two of them were Good Will Hunting and A Beautiful Mind, the actual scripts.
Wow.
And I fused those together, and I created this story of this guy. Tommy Moskowitz is the accumulated Renaissance of man at 23. He's worth over $800 trillion, an A-list actor dating an A-list actress, physical specimen to behold and be beholden to. He is the literal accumulation of all that is good. There's nothing that he hasn't done. If you had a museum devoted to him, you would not see walls that bound the museum. You'd see horizons, because it never ends. But in reality, this gentleman has nothing of the sort in reality. He is alone, emaciated, wasting away beneath delusions of grandeur as a result of a celebrity politician father. The joke being that Tommy's the middle child born between elections, and a weak-willed mother who, as a result of the father's public persona and private monstrosity, has rendered a world in which Tommy is only able to escape through his mind, and has crafted this imaginary world in which he is literally the best at everything. The one caveat being that he is in fact the best at something, but because in his mind he's already the best at everything, he has no incentive to pursue that. In reality, he's a one in a billion artistic talent. He can reproduce pottery by merely glancing at it. And so after a fight with his father on camera during one of his many, many campaign galas. He decamps through Palm Beach and stumbles upon an art studio where a disgraced art dealer comes across him and begins feeding Tommy's delusions to help him make priceless pottery. And it's only at that point in which he begins replicating million-dollar George Orr pots and gets found out that the art dealer, who at one point was going to be played by Michael Clark Duncan, the dude from The Green Mile, that my professor Tom Mankiewicz had wanted to get the screenplay to, then Tom passed away, then Michael passed away, and so my script's been in purgatory for a while, but it's been...
Let's bring it to life.
I'd love to. But,
yeah, you know, let's do it.
So his, what happens is he has to break out of this imaginary world and realize his own potential, and there's a love triangle between him, this girl that he meets, who had originally been a product of the if you're familiar with the Northwood area, it used to be kind of slummy. They've gentrified it since, but this was written back when I was 23, and so it was still that way. And, you know, he encounters this woman who begins to pull him out of his mind, and he leaves behind his imaginary girlfriend. And it's how the forces of the mind and negativity try to pull one back in, and his imaginary world shifts and changes shape to try to prevent him from having any real intimacy and take that leap out of his mind and realize his full potential. I wrote that when I was first draft when I was 22, and it's ultimately, after a few drafts, it's ultimately the script that got me representation. It's won several festivals or placed very highly. And then another script. Would you like to hear about any?
I do. Oh, okay. I do. Right, and right. I think what's your vision of, like, if you could be anything, what would it be? Like, as
titularly?
Like, if you could have the ultimate dream.
Yeah, what does mine look like?
Yeah, what does yours look
where
like?
Without money is not an object.
Yeah, without any constraints, without any blocks.
To be honest,
nothing.
Okay, so just I think totally about like.
And I always feel like your daughter's your muse.
Oh, I don't want to project that onto her. She's definitely my purpose.
Okay.
I don't think I've met my muse yet.
Got it.
And.
Thanks. I'm kidding.
I'm sorry, who are you? I'm Jared. Have we met? Oh, you want to shake my hand? Maybe.
All right. Continue.
I think a muse is a lot like writer's block, where if you don't have it, you can't work. Shouldn't ideally the whole world be our muse?
True.
I see myself...
I'm ready to take that on.
Writing is what I love to do. If I never got paid to do it, if I could still do it, it would be... the thing that, in tandem with my family and those that I love, without the loved ones, for whom are you writing? Because you don't want to you're not just writing for gratification. You're writing to spread your branches and disseminate, you know, what you have to offer to those you care about and to share. And ideally, ideally a document such as a screenplay, when put on the big screen, just like I had one student that I continued to mentor, and I've grown with him. He's a rapper, Luis, Forest Hill student. He's awesome. Actually, he wasn't my student. He just came in during lunch one time with all the teachers and was complaining about being bullied.
So what's from who was he before to after you kind of putting your hands on him?
I don't know. He sends me his rap all the time, and a lot of it's angry stuff, but he's so talented. And I know the fact that he's still producing is a good sign. It's a great sign, and I'm honest with my own struggles. I don't stand in some ivory tower looking down at him,
right,
telling him, you know, I've got it made. You know, he sees my vulnerability and everything else. And my documents, my documents, I've never called them that. My scripts are, they're my raw template for reacting to the world. I don't follow structural rules. That's what I'm told. I'm not very commercial. That my stuff is excellent.
Yeah, but that's one opinion.
Well, no, it's several. It's an agglomeration of fear-driven opinions. Like, that's why I wrote an Orson Welles screenplay, because my manager had told me that you know, IPs and biopics are the ways to go. And that never got picked up by anybody, despite doing very well. And, you know, it's a very fear-driven industry, unfortunately. But going back to what you were saying, because that's where I get my real fire, yeah. I see myself as I can swing it in this world. I see my scripts having some footing in evolving the science behind the themes of the writing. Like another script that I wrote called Viv Through the Night, which has done well recently. It's about a woman whose mother splits into two personalities, and the only personality capable of loving the daughter is dying of a terminal illness. And so when she remits out of that personality, she's healthy, but she can't have a relationship with the daughter. And it becomes this quest that essentially bangs the table for how destructive stories are just as deadly as destructive diseases. Every time this daughter tries to emote and tell the mother about her pain and what's happened to her, the mother switches personalities and begins to die. So by revealing herself to her mother, by telling her mother what it is she needs to express to learn about, the mother begins to die. So she is disincentivized from being honest with herself. If she's honest, she kills her mother. So she keeps that all in, and it begins to destroy her, manifesting through alcoholism, and the mother goes on to alienate the daughter's own daughter, and she has to ultimately choose, you know, standing up for herself and telling her story, solving her story, or, you know, living in fear that her self-worth is not as important as her mother's. And I feel like, you know, I studied with a lot of, it's funny, I feel like I went more to medical school for real through film school, because I studied the physiology of story and how the stories we tell ourselves have very real physiological components. And after my dad passed away, I went to a meditation seminar at the Kripalu Institute in Western Massachusetts, most beautiful scenery, and studied with a gentleman named Howard Schubiner, who actually put together one of the first and most successful NIH-funded studies to show how self-awareness can reduce chronic pain. Because I had been diagnosed with fibromyalgia I was kept taken from my daughter. I went from a meathead-looking guy benching over 500 to not even be able to pump my own gas. That's how my whole story evolved. And I still haven't... They're honking because I still haven't answered your question.
No, you're good.
What would I like to do with... Where do I see myself going? And I see my scripts impelling interest in the mind-body connection and seeing something more than entertainment behind them. Something more than political, too. It's, you know, the physical similarities between people of all creeds and colors are expressed emotionally and vice versa. I see myself traveling to film festivals in places that I'd never thought that I would go to see films that I could otherwise not see. With people I care about. I see myself teaching when I am not in a position to need to teach, because there's a complete difference.
What inspires you about teaching children, even, you know, those that are just not getting it as well?
I was never inspired by teaching. It's just something I've always done. You talk about students not getting things.
Yeah.
What does not getting even mean? Who's to say that... people have equal attention devoted to the process of getting something. Getting is a magical firecracker of a phenomenon. Getting is something different to everybody. I taught intensive reading because that's where they put all the... It's like the hazing ritual for new teachers. Intensive reading is the class that the kids are forced to take with the scarlet letter, which means they didn't do well enough on their standardized testing. So now, not only do they lose an elective because they have to take this piece of shit class, they have the disgrace of being told that they're less than. These are kids. That's where I met my brilliant rapping student. These are the kids who have been through horrific traumas. I'm being recorded, so I'm not going to list any of them. Who, because those traumas don't resolve in a timely enough manner, to appear like they are successful on a transcript, they are given the indignity of and made worse by having to take this class. And so I was in there and I got to see how every student got it. Whatever it was might not have lined up with the syllabus, but then I threw the fucking syllabus out and I showed them movies. And I, you know, their whole thing was, well, you have to learn how to read. I'm looking around and what the fuck does that mean? You have to learn how to read. It becomes this very deconstructionist term. Like I tried to think back about how I came to read, and it was not something that was drilled into me episodically and formally. It just happened. Just like so many great things just happen to kids, and terrible things happen to kids. So how do you happen them in the right direction? And
how do you happen to them in the right direction?
I did a lot of what the opposite of what they told me to do. So there were these fuddy-duddy, you know, like career teachers who brag about how they were hard on the students, but then they came to love them. And then I'd listen to the students and they'd roll their eyes and say, well, these people, you know, I hate so.
How did you inspire your kids?
I was a new teacher, and so I wasn't cynical enough or beaten down enough to really protect myself from the bullshit. I didn't give homework. My grading was almost non-existent. It was basically an absence or presence thing. Did you show me the respect enough to do something to try? I showed them films, and where I saw opportunities to inject life lessons, given that the objective of my course was to produce a mastery of reading, which felt like some sort of experience in a Turkish prison. It was so excoriating and discouraging. Like, I basically used it as an opportunity to teach them whatever was inside of me, which is, I think, all that any teacher can do at any given time. Yes, if you're in a calculus class, you have to, you know, learn derivatives and integrals, and there's a foundation there. It builds on things to pursue greater study, just like I see with my daughter excelling in band. She's in honors band. That's where I was driving her. I guess they're playing Happy Birthday on their horns. I don't know. Two and many more. Sorry.
That's funny.
So I. I kind of sound like the teacher in the Dead Poets Society, you know, where like no structure is the way to go. But with something like this, where these kids are symptomatic of, if not childhood trauma, then, you know, trauma that evolves from being told they're not good enough.
Right.
All of those things are equally deserving of support. And so when it was time for me to leave and to go to the new school up in Central Florida, when I finally got a job with my daughter, these old fuddy-duddy teachers were like, oh, don't tell them why you're leaving. Don't tell them. It's not for them to know. So they kept wanting to create a distance between these kids and me.
And you're someone who's very open.
Well, kids are the sharing. Best lie detectors on the planet.
You're right. That's so true.
I mean, don't ever try to fool a kid. That's their job to fool you.
Yeah.
So I told them I was leaving. I shared this story with my daughter. You know what they did? They threw a party for me. They sang for me. Girls sang for me. They brought in food. I'm like gonna tear up about this.
Aww.
But I want to do this when I'm in a position. I think I'll always be in a position where I could offer something to teach. I mean,
you
we can all
impact people's lives.
We can all offer something all the time if we're vulnerable enough. Isn't that how people become boring? Is when they don't reveal themselves, when they get on with cliches. Oh, how are you? Oh, how's the weather? Oh, how about that game last night? I mean, it's cringy.
So you can impact people's lives, especially children and sort of the next generation.
Sure.
Through your writing.
I hope so. I see my writing. You're absolutely right. I see my writing as like a supercharged bomb of my personal lessons.
Yes.
It's how I give myself. And so it'd be like, yes, teaching. And I would like to you know, not share, not talk about it for vanity's sake, but, you know, I write these things. I wrote these things, one, you know, in the unending effort to discover myself and how I relate to the world and gain clarity. We write and tell stories to, in many ways, rid ourselves of them or to create, to manufacture a sympathetic but bound construct of our own journeys.
Right.
So it's a very therapeutic endeavor to start writing, but when you finish it, when it's something that's finite and unchanging, it becomes the property of everybody else, and then it's incumbent upon you to relate it to other people or to receive how they related it to you. And that's what teaching is, but this time you have 2 hours and nobody gets up to go to the bathroom and nobody's on their phone, you know, ideally.
Right.
And it's also, you know, you plan for a lesson for over, you know, like a couple days in advance, or maybe you do it off the cuff, and with this writing, you're constantly refining. Sometimes it takes years.
Right.
And so it's years of finding clarity and finding ways to make sure that your lessons are superimposable onto others, and then while also creating enough universality for them to find their own lessons. I mean, if it was one lesson, you could just tell them what that lesson is. They don't have to wait 2 hours.
Right.
Across a film.
Right.
Those themes have to be indigenous to whatever they're reacting to, and so they bring their own stories to it.
Right.
And so, I've been around enough people and I've spoken to enough people to know that I have enough interest in people to feel like I'm doing the right thing. And so I think with my writing, I would really love to see myself, my films out there, because without even making a dime, I just feel like they're so fucking important, especially when they're lined up against, you know, the next Avengers film or whatever. Right. You know, like I guarantee you, to Tom Hooper, Cats, and to Judi Dench, and to Idris Elba, Cats meant something more than the mass dismissal that it's getting, and that they're strong enough artists to not really give a shit what people say about it.
Right.
I don't know, you and I saw something powerful.
But I think, yeah, and there's just a lot of humanity. I feel like there was just a lot of, like, just... what's the word? You have more words in your mind than I do.
Goodwill, munificence, I mean, yeah. You know, well-intentioned, you know, craftsmanship. When I was watching that, I kept seeing the depths of these artists coming together to the mere act of their communion.
Yes.
To make this.
Yes. It wasn't just one individual.
No.
Like they introduced themselves as an individual, but all of a sudden it turned into a community.
Right.
So it's almost like it's an extension of themselves, and they needed each other in order to move on.
And these are people whom society has been shown are people who do not need to make any movie to get by. These are people who get to pick and choose their projects till they die.
And they did this for fun.
They did this. And I'm so glad we got to see it. It's pure unadulterated joy, just having this experience.
And I just, you know, and I think a lot of, like, kids just need to, you know, they see that, you know, as cats, they're very lonely beings. And just like, you know, kids, they get caught up in this sort of loneliness. But then all of a sudden, it's like when they escape into, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but... all of a sudden, when there's sort of this trust, they meet people and they have this sort of common ground.
Yes.
All of a sudden, their world gets bigger.
Yes. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they're just like, they would rather be with their people as opposed to being by themselves.
You're so right. You know, I forgot that this movie actually, it was the book was originally written. I think it's T.S. Eliot who wrote the original book. He was a huge cat devotee and just loved the creatures and their mystique.
Yeah.
And yes.
Even just like the beginning where this one cat just got left in the dumpster in a bag.
And they're skulking around trying to figure it out.
She wasn't worthy.
And then eventually she's accepted.
She became accepted. Sure. But she came out of this bag feeling so less than and unworthy. But she was just such a beautiful being.
Yes.
You know, what other cats occurred is that she was just this beautiful being, but how she saw herself was not. And then as the story, and each one of them had their similar experiences, but like they all joined forces as becoming accepted upon each other.
It was really, I think the...
And their life became better.
I think I saw that this film as...
it was all like love.
Well, love, yeah. And a group of creatures needed. Fighting to show that they deserve to exist.
Yeah. And it's even the big cat, like the cat, they're just no matter how your body is, it's beautiful.
Bustopher Jones, or that's James Corden, and then Jenny Anydots, yes. Rebel Wilson, yeah, who lost like 40 pounds after doing that, apparently. Yeah, where she ate the cockroaches. Right. So.
But it's just like they were each one was beautiful in their own right.
You know what?
Super cool.
As a screenwriter, what I found really fascinating about this film is, superficially, it didn't have a lot of plot. There wasn't a lot of twists and turns and everything. What it was an organism. If you think about it, each cat is singing, introducing themselves. To me, subtextually, that meant they're announcing that they deserve to live. They're auditioning to be the Jellicle choice, to go to the heavy side lair. They're auditioning. What they're really doing. What they don't know if they're going to get it or not. But what they're saying in this audition is, this is who I am.
Right.
And so this is a journey into seeing the variety of what's out there and that takes a form.
Right.
And it has nothing, I think, to do with McCavity or who's going to become the choice.
But at the end, they all agreed that this one cat deserves to be...
The one who, if you notice, she's the one who never announced herself. She sang, but she never announced herself.
Yeah.
And I know her name's Francesca Hayward, played the orphan cat, the white ballerina cat. I don't remember her name, though. I don't remember her cat name. But she was our guide through these creatures, kind of... I mean, people would laugh at the fact that we're analyzing cats.
No,
but why did it? Real. Why did it captivate people? And I think that's why they stand for what it is that we all want to announce who we are and be accepted.
We do.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Yeah, and 100%. It was done in a very, very intimate way, It's almost impossible to meet a cat unless you have food. And even if you have food, you meet them for the moments you have food until you don't, and then you're no longer meeting them. And they're gone. They run away. But then when you finally get to know a cat, when you demonstrate enough goodwill, that's that song at the end telling you about the rules, about how to ingratiate yourself to a cat, you know, with like fish paste and pie and all the things that you're supposed to give it to it to so that it will dignify you with its presence.
It's like a human.
Well, it's sort of. I mean, cats are like caricature versions of revealing themselves, because if you ever had a cat as a pet, you start to see all the weird shit that they do. Bouncing around and you know, all these neurotic things that you know kind of encapsulate the mystique of cats. And so, yeah, I... And every cat there just kind of went along with it. Other than to Grizabella, they all just... Nobody was bemused by the fact that James Corden is talking about being fat and eating and doesn't seem to really have a purpose, you know, other than announcing himself. He doesn't...
Right.
I don't think he saved, emancipated any slave children or did anything, you know, that was like... what would you say, philanthropic in, right. in any way. So why is he becoming a center? Why does he deserve screen time? And it's what makes this movie so fascinating is that it doesn't compel you to look for a plot. It, the world just, is so unique that you just
appreciate each yeah, one of them.
Yeah. And any, their anybody,
own, their own character.
And if you can accept the world of the CGI and the fur and the practical effects, then you're gonna be accepting of these characters on a whole. And I guarantee you, the people who liked this film were probably more accepting in general of a lot of things.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so just finishing up, like, how would you sort of to end this interview? Like, how would you, with your words and expressing self-expression, how would you empower these children and other, you know, and their parents and people that could want to hear you? How could you empower them? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
You mean,
how can we help empower these children?
Which specific children?
Suppressed
children? People, children who don't have a voice?
Yeah. Or maybe those that have a voice but don't know how to... Or just children in general. Like, some that are even lost. Like, I don't want them to be lost. Like,
such a complex, sprawling dilemma... You know, that... So when I taught, I had a small window to do a little bit. And the impact that it had, you know, was, at the time, I thought, profound. But, you know, depending on the forces, the external pressures that ensconce these kids, they may find it easy to gravitate back. I don't have an easy answer for how to emancipate children.
Or unlock their potential? Do you have any ideas? Would you be able to do it through your writing?
I hope so. I have the intuitive sense that my writing can do that. Just like my teaching did. And it has to do with everybody who has the idea traverse them that they want children to have a better opportunity to be who they are. It's about not retreating into yourself and being generous. With who you are, and the more generous you are, it doesn't take an intelligent generosity to see that if you feed a cat, it opens up to you. And so, how do you...
If you feed a kid.
Well, when nutrition isn't the issue, and it's an issue of self-assertion and feeling like they deserve to exist, I think just merely creating a forum that doesn't impose upon their boundaries and creating... That's how I got my daughter. How did I succeed in letting my daughter come into my life? Well,
you let go of the boundaries.
One very strong boundary, Christiana, is the title of mother or father. It's a huge boundary. So I cry about this every time that I bring it up, but now that you mentioned it, it's a great beginning. It's not going to probe the depths of these children, but that... That's an exercise that can even engage, unless it comes from the child themselves. But to but to be present and loving, I'm going to answer your question with the anecdote about what I did for my daughter, and I think you can apply it as an extrapolation to children. So you remove these boundaries, and if in the process you know it's like creativity. If you are at ease, it flows out of you. You're going to reveal yourself no matter what, and it's in that revelation, in that vulnerability. If you've given space and reception to the child to be themselves, then you've already moved in that direction. It may not come through some sort of, you know, formal institution of openness, but I think individually, as foot soldiers toward the common good, you know, it's a good start. So when my daughter was 7 years old and I had begun to see her more and more, you know, I knew she didn't call me dad. When we told her that I'm her biological father, she said, "You're not my father, Mr. Jared. God's my father." She had been told, every time the subject of a biological father had been broached, her mother had deflected it, didn't want to talk about it because it was a painful component of her life. And so when my daughter found out, it was difficult for her. She didn't quite know what to do with it because she was confused. And then, you know, her mother, as I found out, had told her that whoever she marries becomes her dad. And so I remember very early on, my sweet little girl couldn't have been more than, you know, 7. Did I show you a picture of her? That's my little girl.
I know. She's beautiful.
Thank you. Not so little. 5'8". Her mom's 5'1". And
wow.
I'm barely 5'10". I had her over at my house, and she asked to use my phone. And she took my phone into my room. And I heard her talking on the phone. And I heard her whisper, "Are we still gonna play board games with Daddy tonight?" And after she hung up, I took her, I got the phone back in, and I said, "Sweetheart, can I talk to you for a second?" And I said to her, I said, "You know who I am, right? You know, biology." She's like, "Yeah." And she started shaking. And I said, "You know, I know you call Mr. Dave Dad. It's her mom's husband at the phone." And she started really shivering. She got scared. She's like, "You do?" Thinking I was going to punish her, be angry. And I said, "Sweetheart, yeah. And I want to let you know it's okay. I love you no matter what you call me. You can call me whatever you want. I just don't want you to feel like you have to hide anything." And Christiana, she started shivering. And I hugged her. And I think I saved her 10 years of therapy. And to this day, never called me dad. Doesn't have to, but she does. She does identify. She's like, you know. She did say recently, she's like, people think my dads are gay because I say I have two dads. I'm laughing, and I even find myself addressing her mom and her dad, and I was like, whatever they're called, and now it's a joke. But
funny.
I never needed to be called dad to her. I loved her. That's love, right? That's all that is.
And that's awesome.
That's when I knew I'd be okay at this.
I love that. We're gonna end it there.
It's a good place to end.
Okay. So, Jared, first, I want to first tell everyone how we met.
That story deserves admission.
So cool. It's great. So cool. I want people to really get that.
So,
in your words.
In this day and age when it's so easy to be cynical about the absence of magic in the real world, we met magically, and it all revolved around a commitment we made to ourselves to do something for ourselves, to sort of boldly jump in a direction that seemed to be being opposed by the entire rest of the world. We met in the movie Cats, a screening in the movie Cats at Palm Beach Gardens. I believe it was Christmas Eve, if not the day before Christmas Eve. And we were both resigned to doing something that we enjoyed. World and opinions be damned. And from my perspective, I got there pretty much committed to enjoying whatever I was going to see because I read about the bad reviews and how much people wanted to take a crap on it. And I knew the people involved were so talented and such profound artists. I said, there's no way there's not something magical in here. And so I walked up to the theater and I saw somebody sitting underneath the poster outside, just sort of surveying the area. It was her and it was me. I was sort of meandering around the posters, you know, trying to figure out, is this someone else who's here to avoid suffering, to escape into something awesome? And so, I can't remember. I think I walked to look at some other posters before it was time to go, and then I walked in, and Cristiano was sitting in the, like, two rows back. I was sitting in the third row, leftmost seat, so I can rock it out at the credits usually. And that's how we met, over cats. And she came and she boldly sat next to me, and we spoke. I realized we both were there to let this piece of magic just sort of envelop us, and we realized we had a lot in common with why we were at the movie. We didn't get into specifics so much. Well, a few, maybe. Our parents passing and the subsequent difficulties of family stuff and the memories that penetrate during the holidays. And then I think at that point we both knew that whatever was going to be on screen, we would never forget it, no matter what. And the movie ended and we had a great talk, and it's one of the best stories I've ever had. It's even better than the story of how I rented from Pauly Shore in L.A., because that didn't really teach me a lesson. This taught me several lessons at once, which I'm still uncovering, and very happy that this organic friendship evolved without the need of any other instrument.
Yeah, me too. I saw Pauly Shore years and years ago. Comedy store.
Yeah. I lived right above it. I rented from him when I was out there in LA after my dad died, and that was just a kind of a typical celebrity experience. Someone trying to cling to fame, and he was nice enough, but I mean, it's forgettable. I mean, I didn't grow as a person because of him.
Yeah. So what do you do? You're a teacher. You're a writer.
I went to school to be a doctor. I double majored in pre-med and creative writing at the University of Florida. I was going to be a physician like my dad. I wanted to also get my MD, PhD, dual degree so that I could develop non-invasive ligament repairs, considering I'd torn both my knees playing football. Actually, the day my mom moved out of my dad's house, I tore my knee in a football game. That's how I remember that. So I had to sit at home with my knee torn, completely immobilized in a brand new house. But then I got all the way to biochem in college, going from like chemistry lab to like creative writing seminars. And everyone, since I was young, was like, oh, you're a writer, you should write, it's what you're good at. So I double majored because I wanted to combine what I was good at with what I thought I loved. And the further along I went in medicine, the more I realized I was doing it because I didn't feel like I had a choice. That, you know, I had to follow my dad's footsteps. He was a doctor in Miami for like 23 years. He ran the intensive care unit at Baptist Hospital in Miami. And then first ever girlfriend I ever had. First girlfriend I ever had at 20 years old. First ever girlfriend. Got pregnant. I was a junior in college. And I knew it was never going to work as a relationship. And so by the time my senior year rolled around and she was close to coming to term, I had already been barred from seeing her since I wasn't going to marry her. And my father the whole time said, you know, Jared, just treat yourself like you're a sperm donor. You know, you'll meet somebody, you'll have other children. You know, they clearly don't want you involved. And it wasn't because I was too young. It was because I knew it wouldn't have been a healthy relationship. I saw what my parents went through. And so I... at that point in time, without the support from my family, I vowed that I would be in my daughter's life when I could. And it just wasn't at that time. I divested myself from my medical aspirations and focused solely on my writing because I realized that's where my passion was. It took many years, but then I had a teacher tell me, my undergraduate advisor told me that my writing was very cinematic. And I, at that point, pursued screenwriting after graduating from UF. Took a year. I managed a gym and did all sorts of odd jobs until I got into a great grad program at Chapman University in Southern California. At that point, I'd seen my daughter once in 2 years.
What's her name?
Madison. And after that, I decided, I'm going to work for my daughter. I'm just distributing it differently. I'll come back home when I can. And since they weren't letting me see her, and there were no film schools worth going to within an hour drive of my daughter, and my father not supporting me, and at that point also being diagnosed with terminal cancer, telling me that he couldn't have a relationship with me if I fought for her in court because it would essentially ruin his life. He didn't want to see me hurt. But I resigned to go to grad school, and I got into the best one. I went to the best one that I could get into. Went out there, made my connections, got my degree. My dad got to see me graduate before he passed away. Still wasn't but seeing my daughter twice a year. She had no idea who I was. After he passed, I went out to LA to take a few more meetings, do a little bit more with a book I was helping my professor write. He created the original Transformers cartoons. His biography just came out a year ago. Took many years because he's very old. He's almost 90. And I came back, and with my connections made, moved first to West Palm when I couldn't get any work near my daughter in Central Florida, then ultimately to Claremont, got work in Claremont, teaching middle school intensive reading up there, after teaching it for half a year, Forest Hill down here, and that's when I began the proceedings to fight for her, since at that point her mother had met a guy. My daughter still had no idea who I was told that she doesn't have a dad, and now fast forward 6 years, and
how's your relationship
one of the best
now?
Relationships. It's my purpose. I am not a writer. I am not a dad per se. But
in this part, yes.
If you reverse that, if you take away my fatherhood, then I don't exist. My daughter resets my orbit every day.
Resets your orbit.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
How does she reset it?
Every day, every waking moment that I'm not predisposed with something that requires my attention, I'm wondering how I can make her life better.
She's
thanking
probably
her.
Wondering the same.
No. She's writing's not the easiest career. I'm fortunate to have a career in it, but it's thankless. It's joyless. It's driven many people to suicide. It's driven many people to insanity and all sorts of negativity. But when you have something that you love more than yourself, and when you yourself think that you love writing, and you love something more than yourself, therefore your writing will never truly own you. And that's what I have with my daughter, and I'm so grateful, and that's... She's just reminded me how important all my relationships are.
Yeah. How so?
Because you can take away everything, but if you don't have people whom you can transmit yourself, really using other people as vessels for what you can offer. I mean, it's not even just having other people, it's loving other people.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, it looks good.
Without that, I would have nothing. I've had a lot taken away from me in the last couple of years, you know. Just with the efforts with my writing, you know, they've required a lot of financial adjustments. They've caused me to strip away a lot of what I thought was important, particularly when.
What is important to you?
Those that I love. My daughter doesn't care what scripts I've sold. I mean, she might like to brag about it, just like I like to brag about my dad at one point. But you know, my dad had his flaws, and that's ultimately what shaped me emotionally, and not what he did for a living.
Right.
You know, so I'm very lucky that, you know, I have a manager. I've written scripts for Lionsgate. I've done a lot, but it's not the glamour lotto ticket that a lot of this looks like. And so
what kind of things do you like to write about?
Well, you were mentioning earlier about the interplay between dreams and reality and how they coordinate. That's the entire constitution, the manifesto of my writing. So the script that got me representation, which Shia LaBeouf's manager recently called Too Insane, was written shortly after was the first screenplay I ever wrote when I decided I was going to write for my daughter. It's called Clay Tommy. After I decided to write, my father, instead of, I thought, being disappointed, I should have known, he's an artist, he wanted to be a filmmaker, but his mother forced him to go to medical school. I was doing what he loved, and one of the ways that he showed that for me was by sending me this great big package of gifts when I got back to the University of Florida, showering me in support. And that included many books on screenwriting, and two of them were Good Will Hunting and A Beautiful Mind, the actual scripts.
Wow.
And I fused those together, and I created this story of this guy. Tommy Moskowitz is the accumulated Renaissance man at 23. He's worth over $800 trillion, an A-list actor dating an A-list actress, physical specimen to behold and be beholden to. He is the literal accumulation of all that is good. There's nothing that he hasn't done. If you had a museum devoted to him, you would not see walls that bound the museum, you'd see horizons, because it never ends. But in reality, this gentleman has nothing of the sort in reality. He is alone, emaciated, wasting away beneath delusions of grandeur as a result of a celebrity politician father. The joke being that Tommy's the middle child born between elections, and a weak-willed mother who, as a result of the father's public persona and private monstrosity, has rendered a world in which Tommy is only able to escape through his mind, and has crafted this imaginary world in which he is literally the best at everything. The one caveat being that he is in fact the best at something, but because in his mind he's already the best at everything, he has no incentive to pursue that. In reality, he's a one in a billion artistic talent. He can reproduce pottery by merely glancing at it. And so after a fight with his father on camera during one of his many, many campaign galas, he decamps through Palm Beach and stumbles upon an art studio where a disgraced art dealer comes across him and begins feeding Tommy's delusions to help him make priceless pottery. And it's only at that point in which he begins replicating million-dollar George Orr pots and gets found out that the art dealer, who at one point was going to be played by Michael Clark Duncan, the dude from The Green Mile, that my professor Tom Mankiewicz had wanted to get the screenplay to, then Tom passed away, and then Michael passed away, and so that my script's been in purgatory for a while, but it's been...
Let's bring it to life.
I'd love to. But,
yeah,
you know,
let's do it.
So what happens is he has to break out of this imaginary world and realize his own potential, and there's a love triangle between him, this girl that he meets, who had originally been a product of the if you're familiar with the Northwood area, it used to be kind of slummy. They've gentrified it since, but this was written back when I was 23, and so it was still that way. And, you know, he encounters this woman who begins to pull him out of his mind, and he leaves behind his imaginary girlfriend. And it's how the forces of the mind and negativity try to pull one back in, and his imaginary world shifts and changes shape to try to prevent him from having any real intimacy and take that leap out of his mind and realize his full potential. I wrote that when I was first draft when I was 22, and it's ultimately, after a few drafts, it's ultimately the script that got me representation. It's won several festivals or placed very highly. Then another script. Would you like to hear about anything?
I do. What's your vision of, like, if you could be anything, what would it be? Like, as
titularly?
If you could have the ultimate dream.
Yeah, what does mine look like?
Yeah, what does yours look
like? Without money is not an object.
Yeah, without any constraints, without any blocks.
To be honest with you, okay, so I think about, like.
And I always feel like your daughter's your muse.
Oh, I don't want to project that onto her. She's definitely my purpose.
Okay.
I don't think I've met my muse yet.
Got it.
And
thanks. I'm kidding.
Sorry, who are you? I'm Jared. Have we met? Oh, you want to shake my hand? Maybe.
Continue.
I think a muse is a lot like writer's block, where if you don't have it, you can't work. Shouldn't ideally the whole world be our muse? I see myself.
I'm ready to take that on.
Writing is what I love to do. If I never got paid to do it, if I could still do it, it would be the thing that, in tandem with my family and those that I love, without the loved ones, for whom are you writing? Because you don't want to you're not just writing for gratification. You're writing to spread your branches and disseminate, you know, what you have to offer to those you care about and to share. And ideally, ideally a document such as a screenplay, when put on the big screen, just like I had one student that I continued to mentor and I've grown with him. He's a rapper, Luis, Forest Hill student. He's awesome. Actually, he wasn't my student. He just came in during lunch one time with all the teachers and was complaining about being bullied.
So what's from who was he before to after you kind of putting your hands on him?
I don't know. He sends me his rap all the time, and a lot of it's angry stuff, but he's so talented. And I know the fact that he's still producing is a good sign. It's a great sign. And I'm honest with my own struggles. I don't stand in some ivory tower looking down at him,
right,
telling him, you know, I've got it made. You know, he sees my vulnerability and everything else. And my documents, I've never called them that. My scripts are, they're my raw template for reacting to the world. I don't follow structural rules. That's what I'm told. I'm not very commercial, that my stuff is excellent.
Yeah, but that's one opinion.
Oh, no, it's several. It's an agglomeration of fear-driven opinions. Like, that's why I wrote an Orson Welles screenplay, because my manager had told me that, you know, IPs and biopics are the ways to go, and that never got picked up by anybody, despite doing very well. And, you know, it's a very fear-driven industry, unfortunately. But going back to what you were saying, because that's where I get my real fire,
yeah.
I see myself as I can swing it in this world. I see my scripts having some footing in evolving the science behind the themes of the writing. Like another script that I wrote called Viv Through the Night, which has done well recently. It's about a woman whose mother splits into two personalities, and the only personality capable of loving the daughter is dying of a terminal illness. And so when she remits out of that personality, she's healthy, but she can't have a relationship with the daughter. And it becomes this quest that essentially bangs the table for how destructive stories are just as deadly as destructive diseases. Every time this daughter tries to emote and tell the mother about her pain and what's happened to her, that the mother switches personalities and begins to die. So by revealing herself to her mother, by telling her mother what it is she needs to express to learn about, the mother begins to die. So she is disincentivized from being honest with herself. She's honest, she kills her mother. So she keeps that all in, and it begins to destroy her, manifesting through alcoholism, and the mother goes on to alienate the daughter's own daughter, and she has to ultimately choose, you know, standing up for herself and telling her story, solving her story, or, you know, living in fear that her self-worth is not as important as her mother's. And I feel like, you know, I studied with a lot of, it's funny, I feel like I went more to medical school for real through film school, because I studied the the physiology of story, and how the stories we tell ourselves have very real physiological components. And after my dad passed away, I went to a meditation seminar at the Kripalu Institute in Western Massachusetts, most beautiful scenery, and studied with a gentleman named Howard Schubiner, who actually put together one of the first and most successful NIH-funded studies to show how self-awareness can reduce chronic pain. Because I had been diagnosed with fibromyalgia I was kept taken from my daughter. I went from a meathead-looking guy benching over 500 to not even be able to pump my own gas. That's how my whole story evolved. And I still haven't... They're honking because I still haven't answered your question.
No, you're good.
What would I like to do with... Where do I see myself going? I see my scripts impelling interest in the mind-body connection and seeing something more than entertainment behind them. Something more than political, too. It's, the physical similarities between people of all creeds and colors are expressed emotionally and vice versa. I see myself traveling to film festivals in places that I'd never thought that I would go to see films that I could otherwise not see. With people I care about, I see myself teaching when I am not in a position to need to teach, because there's a complete difference.
What inspires you about teaching children, even, you know, those that are just not getting it as well?
I was never inspired by teaching. I was never inspired by teaching. It's just something I've always done. You talk about students not getting things.
Yeah.
What does not getting even mean? Who's to say that... Who's to say people have equal attention devoted to the process of getting something? Getting is a magical firecracker of a phenomenon. Getting is something different to everybody. I taught intensive reading because that's where they put all the... It's like the hazing ritual for new teachers. Intensive reading is the class that the kids are forced to take with the scarlet letter, which means they didn't do well enough on their standardized testing. So now, not only do they lose an elective because they have to take this piece of shit class... Sorry if any teachers are listening. They have the disgrace of being told that they're less than. These are kids. That's where I met my brilliant rapping student. These are the kids who have been through horrific traumas. I'm being recorded, so I'm not going to list any of them. Who, because those traumas don't resolve in a timely enough manner to appear like they are successful on a transcript, they are given the indignity of and made worse by having to take this class. And so I was in there and I got to see how every student got it. Whatever it was might not have lined up with the syllabus, but then I threw the fucking syllabus out and I showed them movies. And their whole thing was, well, you have to learn how to read. I'm looking around and what the fuck does that mean? You have to learn how to read. It becomes this very deconstructionist term. Like I tried to think back about how I came to read, and it was not something that was drilled into me episodically and formally. It just happened. Just like so many great things just happen to kids, and terrible things happen to kids. So how do you happen them in the right direction? And
how do you happen to them in the right direction?
I did a lot of what the opposite of what they told me to do. So there were these fuddy-duddy, you know, like career teachers who brag about how they were hard on the students, but then they came to love them. And then I'd listen to the students and they'd roll their eyes and say, well, these people, you know, I hate so-and-so.
How did you inspire your kids?
I was a new teacher, and so I wasn't cynical enough or beaten down enough to really protect myself from the bullshit. I didn't give homework. My grading was almost non-existent. It was basically an absence or presence thing. Did you show me the respect enough to do something to try? I showed them films and where I saw opportunities to inject life lessons, given that the objective of my course was to produce a mastery of reading, which felt like some sort of experience in a Turkish prison. It was so excoriating and discouraging. Like, I basically used it as an opportunity to teach them whatever was inside of me, which is, I think, all that any teacher can do at any given time. Yes, if you're in a calculus class, you have to, you know, learn derivatives and integrals, and there's a foundation there. It builds on things to pursue greater study, just like I see with my daughter excelling in band. She's in honors band. That's where I was driving her. I guess they're playing Happy Birthday on their horns. I don't know. Two and many more. Sorry.
That's funny.
So I kind of sound like the teacher in the Dead Poets Society, you know, where like no structure is the way to go. But with something like this, where these kids are symptomatic of, if not childhood trauma, then, you know, trauma that evolves from being told they're not good enough.
Right.
All of those things are equally deserving of support. And so when it was time for me to leave and to go to the new school up in Central Florida, when I finally got a job with my daughter, these old fuddy-duddy teachers were like, oh, don't tell them why you're leaving. Don't tell them. It's not for them to know. So they kept wanting to create a distance between these kids and me.
And you're someone who's very open.
Well, kids are the best lie detectors on the planet.
You're right. That's so true.
I mean, don't ever try to fool a kid. That's their job to fool you.
Yeah.
So I told them I was leaving. I shared this story with my daughter. You know what they did? They threw a party for me. They sang for me. Girls sang for me. They brought in food. I'm like gonna tear up about this.
Aww.
But I want to do this when I'm in a position. I think I'll always be in a position where I could offer something to teach. I mean,
impact people's lives.
We can all offer something all the time if we're vulnerable enough. Isn't that how people become boring? Is when they don't reveal themselves, when they get on with cliches. Oh, how are you? Oh, how's the weather? Oh, how about that game last night? I mean, it's cringy.
So you can impact people's lives, especially children and sort of the next generation.
Sure.
Through your writing.
I hope so. I see my writing. You're absolutely right. I see my writing as like a supercharged bomb of my personal lessons.
Yes.
It's how I give myself. And so it'd be like, yes, teaching. And I would like to, you know, not share, not talk about it for vanity's sake. But, you know, I write these things. I wrote these things, one, you know, in the unending effort to discover myself and how I relate to the world and gain clarity. We write and tell stories to, in many ways, rid ourselves of them or to create, to manufacture a sympathetic but bound construct of our own journeys.
Right.
So it's a very therapeutic endeavor to start writing, but when you finish it, when it's something that's finite and unchanging, it becomes the property of everybody else, and then it's incumbent upon you to relate it to other people or to receive how they related it to you. And that's what teaching is. But this time you have 2 hours and nobody gets up to go to the bathroom and nobody's on their phone, you know, ideally.
Right.
And it's also, you know, you plan for a lesson for over, you know, like a couple days in in advance, or maybe you do it off the cuff. And with this writing, you're constantly refining. Sometimes it takes years.
Right.
And so it's years of finding clarity and finding ways to make sure that your lessons are superimposable onto others, and then while also creating enough universality for them to find their own lessons. I mean, if it was one lesson, you could just tell them what that lesson is. They don't have to wait 2 hours
right.
across a film.
Right.
Those themes have to be indigenous to whatever they're reacting to, and so they bring their own stories to it.
Right.
And so I've been around enough people, and I've spoken to enough people to know that I have enough interest in people to feel like I'm doing the right thing. And so if it,
you are doing it.
I think with my writing, I would really love to see myself, my films out there, because without even making a dime, I just feel like they're so fucking important, especially when they're lined up against, you know, the next Avengers film or whatever, right. You know, like I guarantee you, to Tom Hooper, Cats and to Judi Dench and to Idris Elba, Cats meant something more than the mass dismissal that it's getting. And that they're strong enough artists to not really give a shit what people say about it.
Right.
I know you and I saw something powerful.
But I think, yeah, and there's just a lot of humanity. I feel like there was just a lot of, like, just... what's the word? You have more words in your mind than I do.
Goodwill, munificence, I mean, yeah. You know, well-intentioned, you know, craftsmanship. When I was watching that, I kept seeing the depths of these artists coming together to the mere act of their communion.
Yes.
To make this.
Yes. It wasn't just one individual.
No.
Like they introduced themselves as an right. individual, but all of a sudden it turned into a community.
Right.
So
right.
It's almost like it's an extension of themselves, and they needed each other in order to move on.
And these are people whom society has been shown are people who do not need to make any movie to get by. These are people who get to pick and choose their projects right. till they die.
And they did this for fun.
They did this. And I'm so glad we got to see it. It's pure unadulterated joy, just having this experience.
And I just, you know, and I think a lot of, like, kids just need to, you know, they see that, you know, as cats, they're very lonely beings. And just like, you know, kids, they get caught up in this sort of loneliness. But then all of a sudden, it's like when they escape into, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but... all of a sudden, when there's sort of this trust, they meet people and they have this sort of common ground.
Yes.
All of a sudden, their world gets bigger.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
All of a sudden, they're just like, they would rather be with their people as opposed to being by themselves.
You're so right. You know, I forgot that this movie actually is the book was originally written. I think it's T.S. Eliot who wrote the original.
Yeah.
Book is a huge cat devotee and just love the creatures and their mystique.
Yeah.
And yes,
even just like the beginning where this one cat just got left in the dumpster
they're skulking around trying to figure it out.
She wasn't worthy,
and then eventually she's accepted.
She became accepted.
Sure.
But she came out of this bag feeling so less than and unworthy. But she was just such a beautiful being.
Yes.
You know, what other cats occurred is that she was just this beautiful being, but how she saw herself was not. And then as the story, and each one of them had their similar experiences, but like they all joined forces as becoming accepted upon each other.
It was really, I think the...
And their life became better.
I think I saw that this film as...
it was all, like, love.
Well, a group of creatures needed. Fighting to show that they deserve to exist.
Yeah, and it's even the big cat, like the cat, they're just no matter how your body is, it's beautiful.
Bustopher Jones or. That's James Corden, and then Jenny Anydots, yes. Rebel Wilson, yeah, who lost like 40 pounds after doing that, apparently. Yeah, where she ate the cockroaches. Right. So.
But it's just like each one was beautiful in their own right.
You know what?
Super cool.
As a screenwriter, what I found really fascinating about this film is, superficially, it didn't have a lot of plot. There wasn't a lot of twists and turns and everything. What it was an organism. You think about it, each cat is singing, introducing themselves. To me, subtextually, that meant they're announcing that they deserve to live. They're auditioning to be the Jellicle choice, to go to the heavy side layer. They're auditioning. What they're really doing. What they don't know if they're going to get it or not. But what they're saying in this audition is, this is who I am.
Right.
And so this is a journey into seeing the variety of what's out there and that takes a form.
Right.
And it has nothing, I think, to do with macavity or who's going to become the choice.
But at the end, they all agreed that this one cat deserves to be...
The one who, if you notice, she's the one who never announced herself. She sang. She sang, but she never announced herself.
Yeah.
And I know her name's Francesca Hayward, played the orphan cat, the white ballerina cat. I don't remember her name, though. I don't remember her cat name. But she was our guide through these creatures, kind of... I mean, people would laugh at the fact that we're analyzing cats, why did it captivate people? And I think that's why they stand for what it is that we all want to announce who we are and be accepted.
We do. I agree with you.
Yeah, and 100%. It was done in a very, very intimate way, and so it's almost impossible to meet a cat unless you have food. And even if you have food, you meet them for the moments you have food until you don't, and then you're no longer meeting them. And they're gone. They run away. But then when you finally get to know a cat, when you demonstrate enough goodwill, that's that song at the end telling you about the rules, about how to ingratiate yourself to a cat, you know, with like fish paste and pie and all the things that you're supposed to give it to it to so that it will dignify you with its presence.
It's like a human.
Well, it's sort of. I mean, cats are like caricature versions of revealing themselves. Because if you ever had a cat as a pet, you start to see all the weird shit that they do. Bounce it around and you know, all these neurotic things that, you know, kind of encapsulate the mystique of cats. And so, yeah, and every cat there just kind of went along with it. Other than to Grisabella, they all just... Nobody was bemused by the fact that James Corden is talking about being fat and eating and doesn't seem to really have a purpose, you know, other than announcing himself. He doesn't...
Right.
I don't think he saved, emancipated any slave children or did anything, you know, that was like, what would you say, philanthropic in any way. So why is he becoming... a center, why does he deserve screen time? And it's what makes this movie so fascinating is that it doesn't compel you to look for a plot. The world is so unique that
you
just
appreciate each one of them.
Yeah. And anybody
in their own character.
And if you can accept the world of the CGI and the fur and the practical effects, then you're going to be accepting of these characters on a whole. And I guarantee you the people who liked this film were probably more accepting in general of a lot of things.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so just finishing up, like, how would you sort of to end this interview? Like, how would you, with your words and expressing self-expression, how would you empower these children and other, you know, and their parents and people that could want to hear you? How could you empower them? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
You mean...
How can we help empower these children?
Which specific children?
Suppressed
children? Children who don't have a voice?
Yeah. Or maybe those that have a voice but don't know how to... Or just children in general. Like, some that are even lost. Like, I don't want them to be lost.
Such a complex, sprawling dilemma, you know, that... So when I taught, I had a small window to do a little bit. And the impact that it had, you know, was, at the time, I thought, profound. But, you know, depending on the forces, the external pressures that ensconce these kids, they may find it easy to gravitate back. I don't have an easy answer for how to emancipate children
or unlock their potential. Do you have any ideas? Would you be able to do it through your writing?
I hope so. I have the intuitive sense that my writing can do that, just like my teaching did. And it has to do with everybody who has the idea traverse them that they want children to have a better opportunity to be who they are. It's about not retreating into yourself and being generous. With who you are, and the more generous you are, it doesn't take an intelligent generosity to see that if you feed a cat, it opens up to you. And so, how do you?
If you feed a kid.
Well, when nutrition isn't the issue, and it's an issue of self-assertion and feeling like they deserve to exist. I think just merely creating a forum that doesn't impose upon their boundaries and creating... That's how I got my daughter. How did I succeed in letting my daughter come into my life? Well,
you let go of the boundaries.
One very strong boundary, Christiana, is the title of mother or father. It's a huge boundary. So... I cry about this every time that I bring it up, but now that you mentioned it, it's a great beginning. It's not going to probe the depths of these children, but that an exercise that can even engage unless it comes from the child themselves. But to be present and loving. I'm going to answer your question with the anecdote about what I did for my daughter, and I think you can apply it as an extrapolation to children. So you remove these boundaries, and if in the process you know, it's like creativity. If you are at ease, it flows out of you. You're going to reveal yourself no matter what, and it's in that revelation, in that vulnerability. If you've given space and reception to the child to be themselves, then you've already moved in that direction. It may not come through some sort of, you know, formal institution of openness, but I think individually, as foot soldiers toward the common good, you know, it's a good start. So when my daughter was 7 years old and I had begun to see her more and more, you know, I knew she didn't call me dad. When we told her that I'm her biological father, she said, "You're not my father, Mr. Jared. God's my father." She had been told, every time the subject of a biological father had been broached, her mother had deflected it, didn't want to talk about it because it was a painful component of her life. And so when my daughter found out, it was difficult for her. She didn't quite know what to do with it because she was confused. And then, you know, her mother, as I found out, had told her that whoever she marries becomes her dad. And so I remember very early on, my sweet little girl couldn't have been more than, you know, 7. Did I show you a picture of her? That's my little girl.
I know. She's beautiful.
Thank you. Not so little. 5'8". Her mom's 5'1". And
wow.
I'm barely 5'10". I had her over at my house, and she asked to use my phone. And she took my phone into my room. And I heard her talking on the phone. And I heard her whisper, are we still gonna play board games with Daddy tonight? And after she hung up, I took her, I got the phone back in, and I said, sweetheart, can I talk to you for a second? And I said to her, I said, you know who I am, right? You know, biology. She's like, yeah. And she started shaking. And I said, you know, I know you call Mr. Dave Dad. It's her mom's husband at the phone. And she started really shivering. She got scared. She's like, you do? Thinking I was going to punish her to be angry with me, right? I said, sweetheart, yeah, and I want to let you know it's okay. I love you no matter what you call me. You can call me whatever you want. I just don't want you to feel like you have to hide anything. And Christiana, she started shivering, and I hugged her. And I think I saved her 10 years of therapy. And to this day, never called me dad. Doesn't have to, but she does. She does identify. She's like, you know. No, she did say recently, she's like, people think my dads are gay because I say I have 2 dads. I'm laughing, and I even find myself addressing her mom and her dad, and I was like, whatever they're called, and now it's a joke. But
great, funny.
I never needed to be called dad to her. I loved her. That's love, right? That's all that is.
And that's awesome.
That's when I knew I'd be okay at this.
I love that. We're gonna end it there.
It's a good place to end.